This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books from the Medieval Institute Publications, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nikki, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Brian Gastel and Dr. Catherine Carter at Western Carolina University about their new edited and translated edition of John Gower's Confessio Amantis. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Brian and Dr. Catherine. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about yourselves and your research before we begin talking about Gower.
Sure. So I'm a professor of English here at Western Carolina University, where I teach primarily early British literature, among a number of other things. I got my PhD at the University of Delaware, and my research focuses primarily upon Gower and Chaucer and other late Middle English texts and authors.
And I teach in English education here. I also teach some of the poetry classes. I got a PhD in literature at Delaware also. That is how we met. And I have several collections of contemporary poetry with LSU Press, and I write a lot of poems.
Wow, it seems like you guys cover quite a range in terms of your research and your talents. So could you tell us a little bit about who John Gower is and what drew you to editing such a lengthy poem of his?
Sure. So John Gower was a poet who lived at the end of the 14th and the beginning of the 15th centuries. he was a contemporary and a friend of Geoffrey Chaucer's, who more people probably are aware of than Gower himself. But Gower's work is extremely important in a number of ways for the period. Not the least of which is that Gower was a trilingual poet. England, especially London at the end of the 14th century, was very much a trilingual culture, with English as the vernacular and Latin as the language of education and French as the language of the court and the language really of art for much of the continental context. And we have long important works in French, English, and Latin from Gower, whereas we only have the English works from Chaucer. The Confessio Amantis, which we translated, is some 33,000 lines long, so it is a very long poem. It is one of the longest poems in the English language, which is probably why it's never been translated in its entirety and into verse before. and it is hard to categorize in terms of its genre. It partakes of quite a number of genres, but it is basically a frame narrative which starts out with the lover, Amans, bemoaning the fact that his beloved does not love him, and he is visited by Venus and Cupid, and Venus sends him her priest named Genius to try to cure him of his love sickness. Genius is an interesting figure, and the way that Genius is going to attempt to cure him of his lovesickness is to hear his confession and to tell him a series of stories that will hopefully teach him how to love or how to not love. The work is divided up into books with 8 books, 7 books of which are devoted to the deadly sins. So, you know, avarice and lust. And 1 book is devoted to the education of kings on how to be a good king. So there are dozens and dozens and dozens of stories that are told through the course of the poem. And most of those are drawn from classical mythology, primarily Ovid, from biblical traditions, from historical texts. So it tends to be a very encyclopedic work that includes works that were very influential and important for many of the thinkers and writers of the period. Oh, I want to talk a little bit about what drew us to this?
Well, I believe there was some discussion at Kalamazoo.
Ah, yes. So I'm a member of the John Gower Society and academic organization devoted to the study of Gower. And several years ago, the Gower Society at its annual meeting developed a working group to try to focus on getting Gower taught more in schools, especially in secondary higher education. And it identified a number of impediments and issues related to teaching Gower in colleges and universities, one of which was the lack of a good, complete translation into modern English. Especially at the lower levels, if you're teaching, say, freshman and sophomore, where you might not be teaching Middle English, Gower's Middle English is not that difficult, although it can be tricky at times. But in many classes these days, you don't teach the texts in the original Middle English. So having a complete translation would be very helpful for that. Catherine and I had been talking about this prior to that meeting. I should probably, we could probably get out there at this point that Catherine and I are spouses, so we have a very close working relationship in that way. And I had been talking with Catherine about trying to translate some of the Confessio even prior to this, but I went to the Gower Society and offered our services and said if we were to undertake this project, which we knew would be pretty substantial given the length of the poem, is this something that the Society would be interested in? And they embraced it wholeheartedly and have supported us throughout.
You spoke a little bit about the division of the poem into these multiple books. So I'm curious about the division of labor, because you brought up that you guys are spouses. So was there any friction or issues being married to your co-editor and co-translator? And what was kind of the division of labor when translating this lengthy poem?
Well, we set up in what we call the Mead Hall. It is a large den with a large TV on one end. And I am much the faster typist, so I was the scribe throughout. And I would cast onto the large TV screen. And we started out, we'd read a line and offer a couple of renditions. And after we had either agreed or fought about it and disagreed, I would put the line into the format, and Brian can maybe tell you some about the format that we used. It's a bit sticky, but it's quickly developed. The longer we did this, the more invisible Brian became behind this tower of reference books. You know, we kept adding book upon book. He always had the MAD and the OED and now open. And it would get so that I would translate 10 or 20 or 50 lines while he was going down a reference rabbit hole. And then we would stop and go back, and he would perhaps correct my translation. And I read Middle English, but obviously not as well as he does. And, you know, we might argue about some of the lines that we had translated. But eventually we'd usually reach some kind of consensus.
Yeah, I think the translation was very collaborative. Of course, Catherine is, you know, very much the poet, and her poetry is itself is quite formal usually. So her knowledge of the poetics at work in Gower was just wonderful to have in a project like this. But she was certainly going along, and her Middle English is nothing to sneeze at either. So she was doing pretty well kind of going through, and then we would just kind of go back and change things as we went along. The rest of the translation, of course, is only part of the edition. the rest of it included a number of other kind of divisions, if you want to talk some about.
Yes. One of the main reasons Brian is first author is that he did all the heavy lifting on the notes, most of the intro, the name glossary. I mean, epic numbers of notes and everything. He talked with Andy Galloway about using his Latin glosses. I mean, there's really kind of no end to the amount of what for me would be painful work, I guess.
Yeah, and I found that quite enjoyable, kind of doing that editorial work. We also worked very closely together on the introduction, which is fairly substantial, and I provided the kind of Gower context and the historical context. And Catherine wrote, I think, very eloquently about Gower's poetics and those sort of choices that we made in translating his poetry. So we'd like to think of it as very collaborative, that it wasn't, you know, we had different things that we had different strengths in, but it was very collaborative.
It seems like such a lengthy collaborative process, and one that is conflicted in some ways with pleasure and annoyance, depending on which side of the room you're on when it comes to either editorial glosses or poetics. So could you speak a little bit more about some of the pleasures or the frustrations that you encountered besides the editorial glosses while working on this project?
Well, I think that, I mean, if I start with some of the frustrations, our goal was to create a clear modern English translation. And when we got around to the point where we were also putting it into octosyllabic lines, it was sometimes difficult to try to render Gower's language into modern English when he was so good at taking a single word that had valences in Middle English that we just don't have anymore. There was no single modern English word we could use to replace that Middle English. So that was sort of a frustration. And we were also frustrated sometimes with his lines. He could be a little convoluted with his syntax at times. We were very fortunate to have colleagues and friends who were helping us out along the way. We had a social media group that we would turn to and post passages where we would say, we don't quite understand what's going on here. Can we have some help? And they were wonderful about giving us feedback for that. We've acknowledged those in the acknowledgments. We were very fortunate to have had the input of Bob Yeager, who is perhaps the expert in Gower these days. And he read every single line of the translation and provided assistance. It was frustrating sometimes to come up with what we thought was a very good translation. And Bob's response was, no. It was like, okay, we need to go back to that. I would say that the greatest pleasure was working together on this. We loved working together on this. And when it came to an end, we were sad. We really missed that kind of work. It was just wonderful. in part, I think, because Gower is what he is, right? His texts talk about love. It talks about, you know, how to behave in relationships of all sorts. And his approach to relationships is one based on kindness and forgiveness and compassion. And it was lovely working with a spouse on a project like that.
There were also pleasurable moments. There's one of Bob's notes further on. He said, "You guys are getting better at this." And we felt deeply honored at that point. But yes, it was fun. And I don't know quite how to put this without being struck by lightning, but the pandemic was very well timed for this project. I doubt we would be through now if there had not been all this time in which all you could do was kind of stay where you were and do what you did. And it passed the pandemic very comfortably.
It seems like the perfect project for a pandemic, as fortunate or unfortunate as the pandemic happened to be in this particular situation. So,
Chaucer calls him Moral Gower, which was not perhaps, or a bit of a two-edged compliment. But it's true, actually, that, you know, you read this and you cannot help but apply it to your own situation. At one point during the proceedings, we went to visit some family who were kind of frustrating and difficult. And fortuitously, we were working on book five with our wrath. And by the time we had sat down and translated a bit, I felt much less wrathful.
It sounds like Gower provides the perfect amount of advice for situations.
Maybe a bit too much advice at times, but there's appropriate advice in there somewhere if you work at it. Yes.
Genius is always, Haman says something and genius says, "Well, let me offer you an instructive example." And by late in the process, you know, it'd be like, "So what do you want for dinner?" And the other one would say, "Well, I have an instructive example here." There were many instructive examples.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the poetics, if that is okay with you. So why was it so important to render the lines as octosyllabic for this particular translation?
It is a poem. And our initial version, when we went all through it the first time,
first draft, yeah.
we tried to kind of keep it in the ballpark, but we were not trying all that hard. And some of the lines render into modern octosyllabic or iambic tetrameter very, very easily. Others do not, very much not easily.
Our first draft was mm-hmm. very much focused on a literal, mm-hmm. clear, literal translation. And we struggled with, did we want this to be a prose translation? Did we want this to be a verse translation?
Did we want to try to do the whole thing in iambic tetrameter? And we thought about it.
Yeah.
And it was tempting, right? I mean, that would have its charms. I mean, it would be so much closer to the music of the original. But yeah, it's at some point, as with the Tiller translation, when you start to prioritize the poetics over the literal content, you're going to get away from the literal content. And that's not what an undergraduate classroom needs. But we came to the end of the first version, and we prepared to sit down and go through it again. And that was when it seemed to me that it was time to commit and try to do it at least in octosyllabic lines.
We finished that first run through, and as we went to go back through to do the reread, as of course we wanted to do no matter what, Catherine looked at me and said, "Let's make it octosyllabic lines." And my response was to make a run to the liquor store, where I would prepare for us attempting to go into octosyllabic lines. But as Catherine said, yeah, it's, you know, I think it's important to reflect some of the poetry as much as you can. She referred to an earlier translation. Parts of the Confessio were translated in the early 60s by Terence Tiller, who was a British poet, and translated into rhymed iambic tetrameter. And it's a you know, It's a pretty translation. It is often very far off from what Gower is saying. And that is sort of problematic. The other thing is that Tiller was interested, for some reason, more in the structure, the sections between the tales, the conversations between Genius and Amans. And my sense in the classroom in particular is that students want the stories, right? They want, and these are good stories. You know, we're talking, you can't go wrong when you're pulling stories from Ovid and from the romance tradition and from biblical stories. It's hard to go wrong with those stories. We're wondering maybe, you know, we might kind of talk a little bit about that process by reading a passage. One of the passages that struck us as Gower's more beautiful sections comes from his retelling of the Jason and Medea story. Mm-hmm. And it's it's where Medea is preparing to work her magic to try to give Jason's father, Aeson, his youth back. Medea is a great classical figure in that kind of magic and witchcraft tradition. And his poetry is haunting and powerful, I think, at this point. And we kind of hope that we're able, especially with the octosyllabic line, to kind of emulate this. So this is from book five. And she's, and I'll read the Middle English and Catherine will do our translation. As she's about to start casting her spell. The world was still on every seed, with open head and foot all bar. Her hair to spread, she gone to far, upon her clothes girt she was all speechless. And on the grass she glowed forth as an adder doth. None otherwise she knock off, till she come to the fresh flood, and there a wheel she withstood. Thrice she turned her about, and thrice ache she gone doon loot, and in the flood she wet her hair, and thrice on the water there she gaspeth, with the dretching ond, and the she took her speech on hand. First she began to clap, and call upward unto the stairs all, to wind, to ire, to say, to land, she prayed, and ache held up her hand, to Echates, and gone to Cree, which is goddess of sorcery. She said, helpeth at this need, as ye madden may to spada, when yasen calm the fleece to seca, so help me nu, Iokasecha. With that, she looketh, and was war, doon, fro the ski there come a char the witch dragons about to draw. And though she gone her head doon bow, and up she stee, and fair and well, she drove forth both char and well above in the air among the skies. So that's, you know, calling forth the dragon to fly in the sky.
Yes. And this one, this passage was quite easy to kind of stick to it faithfully. We have some other examples of more difficult passages. But this one, in some cases, Gower shoves the subject 12 lines down, and we tried to bring it somewhere that a new reader could find it. In this case, not at all. This is a very straightforward passage. The world was still all around her. Barefoot and with uncovered head, she began to spread out her hair, and then to girdle up her clothes, and silently upon the grass she glided forth like an adder. She chose no other direction until she reached the fresh flood tide, and there she stood a little while. Then she turned three times round about, and three times she laid herself down, and soaked all her hair in the flood, and three times in the water there she gasped breath like one drowning. And afterwards began to speak. First, she began to cry and call upward toward all of the stars, to wind, to air, to sea, to land. She prayed and also raised her hand and cried aloud to Hecate, who is goddess of sorcery. She said, "Ah, help me in my need, and as you helped me to succeed when Jason came to seek the fleece, so help me now, I do beseech." With that, she looked and was aware of a chariot from the sky, which was drawn forward by dragons. And then Medea bowed her head and mounted up, and fair and well she drove forth chariot and wheel into the air among the skies.
So hopefully, you know, when people read this, and the edition is primarily meant as a student edition, but we do hope that it could be used beyond that. I think that some of my colleagues who are professionals in the field, some academics, might find it useful for some of the passages in Gower that really are quite tricky. And there are some, and we work very, very hard to tease through those. But also we hope that it will appeal to a more general audience, a wider audience, people who are interested in medieval literature, medieval culture more generally, the romance tradition, and even, you know, the retellings of these great stories from the past.
It was lovely to hear you read from the passage and showcase one of the more easier passages. Do you guys have an example of one that would be more difficult or was more difficult in the process?
We do.
Athra, I would imagine.
Yes. Well, we take your pick, really. There are quite a lot, but I'm looking for the one with the fell fiends. Ah, here we are. In this one, this is book in
this is book eight.
This is book eight, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Toward the end. Gower is comparing God to the fallen angel Lucifer. Do you want to read that, lest I stumble on Middle English in front of everybody?
"But Lucifer, he put awaya, with all the root apostasized of him that ben to him a lead, which out of heaven into the hell, from angelus into fiendis fell."
And that, it's not that it's unclear, it's that there are so many valences to the words he is actually using. Mm-hmm. He ends up with that image of Fendus Fella and
Fell Fiends.
Fell Fiends. But there is this pun in there. Fell, it can mean deceitful or treacherous, very appropriate for fiends. It can also mean fierce, cruel, terrible, and malevolent, also good for fiends, you know, I can feel the fell of dark not day kind of thing. But there is really no way to render it because he is calling them fell fiends, but also fallen fiends.
Right.
I mean, this, both things all at once. And Gower does this all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you had 20 syllables, you still couldn't really explain it. So we wound up with something fairly basic, who fell from heaven into hell, changing from angels to fell fiends. And it was tempting to keep the rhyme, but that's not how a contemporary reader would say it. And even so, we don't get I've used fell twice to kind of get that sense of fallen, but it's not the same.
And I would say that the bulk of the notes in the text itself aren't contextual or explanatory notes. They are notes about the language. So one of the things that we've done in our edition is when we've come across a word where we really had to struggle to try to find a way to reflect Gower's ability to call upon those valences. And also as a poet who is a writer who is versed in Latin and French, he's drawing upon those traditions as well. So, you know, the bulk of the notes will provide the original word or the original phrase from Middle English, and then note all of the different valences of that term right? So that a reader or a student can hopefully decide for themselves how best to understand that passage is, given the limits of a modern English translation. So one of the other passages that we kind of struggled with is in one of the more well-known of Gower's tales, which is the Tale of Florent, which serves as the basis for Chaucer's Wife of Bath's Tale. It's the same kind of story, and most scholars, not all, but most scholars believe that Gower based his Wife of Bath's Tale on Gower's. Chaucer's based his on Gower's. So when in that story, when the knight brings home the loathly lady, the old woman, to marry her, the narrator says, "On privily with ute noise, he bringeth this foule greate coise." He brings this foul great, and then we have this Middle English word coise. And coise, if you look it up in the Middle English dictionary, can mean rump or haunches, or it can be a disparaging term for an ugly woman. The issue is that the attestation of a disparaging term for an ugly woman is basically Gower, right? I think it's also in Lydgate's Siege of Thebes, who probably knew Gower. But the saying that is the definition is sort of circular, right? But there are other attestations for the rump or haunches. So if we say he brings this foul grate, and then you have this rump or haunch with you, we had thought briefly about possibly translating it as he brought forth this ugly piece of ass, which would be the kind of tenor of modern English. But that would be a surprising thing for genius to say. It would be a real change in his character. So we ended up translating it as he brought this hideous monster. But we put in the note that information about the word coise, because for us to say, oh, that is not within genius's character to say something like that, is an interpretation of genius, and we didn't want to force that into our translation. So we wanted to make sure that a reader could decide for themselves. Maybe they think that genius is the kind of person who might eventually say this about an old woman. And that would have implications for gender and possibly sexuality and those sorts of things.
Yeah, so that's an interesting translation choice to try to not force an interpretation upon a text and to leave it kind of open for readers' interpretations. So since this is part of a teen series, and the edited edition's primary audience is both scholars, both in medieval studies, in romance, and students, what sort of pedagogical considerations or challenges might you have faced in addition to this particular pejorative term that you deal with in your glosses or your translations or your introduction?
Well, we tried to... We have a fairly substantial introduction that is basically the kind of introduction we would want our students to have. So that was very much on our minds, making sure that it contained a lot of contextual information for someone who may not be familiar at all with the period, much less Gower. And it was similar for the notes. We tried to balance what you might call very basic notes, the kind of notes that somebody who is in the field would not, of course, need, with some of the more advanced notes when we thought it was appropriate. It's also one of the reasons we chose to have a name glossary. And the name glossary at the end, which runs to some 800 names, 807 to 800 name, proper names in the Confessio. Each name is provided a brief one-sentence description of who this person is, just so that a beginning reader could look that name up in the back and say, okay, now I know who this is. And we didn't have to annotate it each time that name appeared in multiple stories, perhaps throughout the course of this 33,000-line poem. It's one of the things I think that we were so pleased with for working with the Medieval Institute publications is their willingness to work with us on the format and the layout of the edition so that we could have the entire work in one volume, which was very important to us, but also in a layout that allowed students to easily engage with the text, but not be so encumbered with the apparatus. So,
and in the name glossary, Brian strove to spell the names more or less as you would find them on Wikipedia for, you know, the beleaguered undergrad who needed to go check a story.
Instead of trying to sift through multiple spellings of names.
The spelling was not yet regularized.
Yeah.
Even within Gower, they're not always spelled the same.
And I think also our choice to really work on moving the subject and predicate up to the front of poetic senses, making sure it was really clear who was doing what.
Yes. I should have looked harder for one of those very long passages where you're just reading along and 12 lines later, you know, and you're kind of waiting to take a breath and you haven't found a main verb yet. Then come on, Gower. So we have tried to move the verb up. We've got a bit from book three here. Now, do you want to read the Middle English?
So this is just a brief four lines. Ha, wicked tongue, woe they be, for men saying that the hard of bone, although himself in have anon, a tongue breaketh it all to paces. And this is about wicked tongues and wicked speech.
Yes, all genius does not approve. But what we have there, men say that the hard bone, although it contains no bones, can be broken. A tongue breaks the bone all to pieces. And that's pretty convoluted for a contemporary reader. So we wound up saying, for as men say, although the tongue has not a bone at all itself, yet it breaks hard bone to pieces. We were trying to clarify the pronoun referent there. And make it clear that the tongue is breaking the bone, not the bone breaking the tongue, which is kind of what it sounds like in the original.
Yeah, he could be possibly positively Miltonic at times with his poetic syntax. So,
and very poetic at the same time, which is probably the main struggle of this translation effort. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the ghost in the room behind Gower's poetry and bring up Chaucer. So you point out that Gower attempted to establish himself as a famous English poet and was one who conversed with Chaucer, was friends with Chaucer. And so I'm wondering, do you ever see this friendship between Chaucer and Gower as an influence on the poem? Or how does Chaucer ghost through a poem, in other words?
How much time do you have?
it's a great question. It's an issue that of course scholars debate to a great deal. We know they knew each other. Chaucer gave Gower his power of attorney when he went abroad. They reference each other in their works. So I mentioned earlier the Tale of Florent as a work that Chaucer probably drew upon for his Wife of Bath's Tale, but also the Gower's Tale of Constance and Chaucer's Man of Law's Tale are comparable tales. They both tell the tale of Tereus, Procne, and Philomela in very, very different ways. Perhaps one of the more apparent references in the Confessio, one of the things that makes the Confessio Montis complicated to read, especially as a modern reader, is its intertextual nature within itself. So there's the Middle English poem, but there are interlinear Latin verses. There are short Latin verses that come at certain places between the lines of the poem that serve as musings on the topic at hand, basically. There are also Latin glosses, glosses that comment upon the content of the poem. Sometimes in some manuscripts, those glosses appear marginal and in the margins of the poem. And in other manuscripts, they appear interlinearly, very much like the interlinear verses. But we felt, since most scholars, I think it's fair to say, believe that those are authorial, that those are Gower's verses and glosses, that it was important to include those in the text itself. So we've managed to do that using Andy Galloway's English translations of the Latin, for which we're very grateful. Another complicating factor is that the Confessio Amantis survives in different versions. There are some earlier versions which are devoted to, which are dedicated to Richard II. And then there are some later versions. These versions, sometimes are referred to as recensions, early recensions, later recensions, Ricardian recensions, Lancastrian recensions. The later recensions dedicated to Henry of Lancaster. And most scholarship quotes from and uses the later recensions, the later versions, the Lancastrian, and we've used that as our base text for the translation. But we've also included all of the translations of all of the passages from the earlier versions that aren't in the later. So one of the appendices has those translations, so you can actually see the difference between the earlier and later versions. In one of those versions, at the very end of the poem, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody who hasn't read the poem, but there's a great reveal at the end of the Confessio Amantis, and Venus returns to talk to Amans, the lover, and poor Amans, through 30,000 plus lines of poetry, hasn't learned a whole lot about love. He's still pretty much... He's in the doghouse, and Venus returns to basically chastise him and say, look, dude, you got to give this up. I mean, you're hopeless, right? In the early version, in the Ricardian version, there is a great reference to Chaucer at this point. When Venus says to Amans, I'll just read our modern English translation. And greet Chaucer well when you meet as my disciple and poet. For in the flower of his youth, in sundry ways as he well could, he made many a glad ditty and song of love, all for my sake. And now those songs fill all the land. So I'm especially obliged to him above every other. Therefore now, in his elder days, you shall tell this message to him. That he, given his advanced years, should bring all of his work to an end, like a man who is my own clerk, and make his testament of love, just as you've made your shrift above, so that my court may record it. Gower is basically having Venus, in the poem, say to Chaucer, you've done really well by me, but you're getting a little long the tooth. Maybe you better stop writing about love. It's one of the most hilarious, like, disses in literary history, right? So that's one of the kind of great passages where Chaucer gets evoked. But beyond that, there's a whole host of other things to think about in terms of Gower and Chaucer. Chaucer may well have based his portrait of the man of law upon Gower, because... Mm-hmm. We think Gower was involved in the law in some way, shape, or form. And at the end of Troilus and Cressida, Chaucer's great romance, he dedicates it to moral Gower, as Catherine says. And sometimes I wonder if even that might have been a little dig, because all you have to do is tell somebody that a piece of literature is moral to have them not read it, right?
For sure. So we've taken up quite a bit of your time, Brian and Catherine. But before we end, I just want to ask, why should people be reading Gower? What does Gower teach us about being human?
Really, you name it, he probably touches on it somewhere, and he's 33,000 lines. And you could certainly say that he prioritizes kindness, even allowing that his word kinda also means nature. There is a great emphasis on kindness, on mercy. But also, and this is not something that is really directly addressed until arguably book 8, Amon spends a lot of time kidding himself, and every time genius will say, so, you know, I've just told you 100 lines about this sin. Tell me, my son, are you guilty of it? And Amon says, oh, no, no, not at all. And then he will give you a lengthy spiel, which in general often reveals that he kind of is. And so this kind of delusion throughout, it arguably tells you, you know, to kind of be aware that we all kid ourselves. We all twist stories to our own ends. You know, that we have trouble taking responsibility for our own stuff, and maybe suggest that we try harder.
And genius, I think, is not that much better. He's supposed to be educating Amon's, and he is supposed to be telling Amon's, you know, so here's this story, and this is what this story teaches you about love and about this sin. And there are many times where we as readers will read that and go, no, that's not what it teaches.
That at all.
There's something else going on here. Can't you see this? And it seems pretty clear that at least I believe it's pretty clear that Gower wanted us to be skeptical of what both of these people were saying, and to recognize that it's very difficult for us as human beings to be self-reflexive and to know about ourselves. And the stories themselves become the way that we learn things, that it's less about what people tell us what something means than what we take from those stories. And one of the great things I think about the Confessio is we can approach each of these stories individually from that standpoint. We can take away different things from each of these stories. But also as a whole, when you put them all together and you read the entirety of the Confessio, which we have now done many more times than I kind of wish we had, but when you do that in its entirety, it teaches you something different, and you take something different away from it.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing project to have worked on. So I wanted to take the time to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you take care.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Very much.